The grasser's lumbering pace was smooth and soothing. To make better time, it walked on both hind and mid-limbs. This put its back at such an angle that Mace's rear-facing saddle let him recline somewhat, his shoulders resting on the grasser's broad, smooth spine, while Nick rode the foreshoulder saddle, peering over the top of its head. During the day, he saw the ack-dogs in glimpses through the jungle as they ranged the rugged terrain. They went before and behind, patrolling to guard the humans from jungle predators, of which these jungles hid many that were large enough to kill a grasser. The three acks were bonded to Besh, Lesh, and Chalk. Nick had no ack of his own. Day travel was a dreamlike flow, from jungle gloom to brilliant sun and back again, as they crossed grasser roads, the winding strips of open meadow left behind by grasser herds as they ate their way through the jungle. These were often the only times he'd see Chalk and Besh and Lesh, their grassers and their acks. Using the ack dogs to keep in contact, they could spread out for safety. Though they could have moved faster by following the grasser roads, frequent overflights by militia gunships made that too risky. Nick informed him that men riding grassers were shot on sight. Every hour or two, the axe gave warning of approaching gunships. Their keen ears could pick up the hum of repulsor lifts from over a kilometer away, despite the jungle's constant buzz and rustle, whir and screech, and even the distant thunder of the occasional minor volcanic eruption. Mace got enough glimpses of these gunships to have an idea of their capabilities. They looked to be customized versions of ancient Sinar turbostorms, blast boats retrofitted for atmospheric close assault work. Relatively slow, but heavily armored, bristling with cannons and missile launchers, large enough to transport a platoon of heavy infantry. They seemed to travel in threes. May stood in a universe of rain, as though the jungle trees and ferns and flowers had grown at the foot of a towering waterfall. Rain pounded through leaf and branch with a roar that made conversation possible only in shouts. Visibility was only a handful of meters. It was just barely good enough that he could see the corpses. They hung upside down, elbows bent at a strange angle because their hands were still tied behind them. Mace counted 7 bodies. Birds and insects had been at them, as well as the vine cats. They'd been hanging for a while. Through the colorless tatters that were all that remained of their clothing, it was impossible to tell even if they had been men or women. Mace was only moderately certain that they had been human. He stood beneath them, looking up into the empty eye sockets of the two that still had heads.
"Is this what you felt?" Nick shouted down from the saddle.
Mace nodded. Echoes of these murders howled in the force around him. He'd been able to feel it from hundreds of meters away. "This place stank of the dark side. We should bury them."
"We should get out of here."
"What?"
"Mount up. We're leaving."
"We can't just leave them for the scavengers."
"Sure we can, and we will."
Nick leaned down toward Mace, and on his face was something that might have even been pity.
"If those are Koronai, to give them any kind of decent burial will only light a giant 'we were here' advertiscreen for the next band of irregulars or militia patrol, and give them a pretty good idea of when. If those are Balawai..."
He glanced up at them. Everything human left his face. He lowered his voice, but Mace could read his lips.
"If they're Balawai," he muttered, "this is already better than they deserve."
Day. They were exposed in a notch pass through a razorback ridge. Some long-ago groundquake had knocked a gap here. Nick reined in their grasser.
"Lesh is in trouble."
He wheeled the grasser and they galloped back through the notch. From Mace's rear-facing saddle, he watched Chalk overtaking them on her way back from her position on point. Her grasser was the fastest of the four, and it carried only half the load of Nick's. On the descending curve of the pass, someone was down. An ack dog nosed him nervously. Lesh. Lesh was in convulsions. His face had twisted into a rigid mask, a blind gape at the empty afternoon sky. He bucked and writhed, hands clutching spastically, heels drumming the rocks. Dropping to a knee, Mace reached for the medpack scanner. Chalk said, "Leave it." Mace looked up at her. She gave him the head shake. "Dead already." Mace picked up the scanner anyway and slid the medpack cover open to activate the display. Lesh was infected. Unidentified blood-borne parasites had collected in his central nervous system. They had now entered a new stage in their life cycle. They were eating his brain.
"Fever wasps,"
Nick said hoarsely. He was almost as pale as Besh.
"No telling when he might have been stung. Thistle chewers go faster. The larvae like the bark. When they hatch..."
He swallowed and his eyes went thin. He had to look away.
"They'll hatch from his skull. Through his skull. Like an eggshell."
The pure, uncomplicated horror on his face told Mace this wouldn't be the first time he'd seen it happen. "The medpack says he can still be saved." It took only a second to charge a spray hypo with thanatazine. "We can put him in suspended animation. Slow down the wasp larvae. Until we can get him to Pellic Ball in a full hospital. Even if he's identified..." Besh looked up at him and shook his head in a mute no. Mace brushed past him and knelt at Lesh's side. "We can save him, Besh. Maybe it'll mean giving him up to the militia, but at least he'll be alive." Besh caught Mace's arm. His eyes were raw, spidered with blood. Again, he shook his head.
"Master Windu."
Nick picked up the medpack case and glanced at the readout.
"Lesh is way more advanced than this thing says."
"Medpack scanners are extremely reliable. I can't imagine it's wrong."
"It's not wrong," Nick says softly. He turned the case so that Mace could check the screen again.
"These aren't Lesh's readings."
"What?"
Besh, looking at the ground, touched his own chest with the tips of his fingers, then sagged. He seemed to crumple in on himself, breath leaving him along with hope and fear. His force aura shaded into black despair. Mace looked from Besh to Nick and back again, and then at Lesh spasming on the rocks, and then at the spray hypo still clutched nervelessly in his hand. "Not because the jungle kills you," Nick had said. "Just because it is what it is." Nick retrieved the medpack scanner and waved it near Mace's head.
"You're okay," he said thinly, licking pale sweat from his upper lip. "No sign of infestation."
He turned to Chalk, frowning down at the medpack's readout. His shoulders slumped and his hands started to shake. He had no words, but he didn't need any. She read her fate on his face. She stiffened and her mouth went thin and hard. Then she turned away and marched downslope. Nick turned his stricken look on Mace.
"Master Windu?"
He held out the medpack scanner imploringly.
"Don't make me do my own reading, huh?"
Mace quickly scanned Nick's spine and skull. The readings indicated a clear negative, but Nick didn't seem much relieved.
"Yeah, well," he said with understated bitterness. "If I was gonna die in the next day or two, I wouldn't have to worry about taking care of them."
"Taking care of them?" May said. "Is there a treatment?"
"Yeah."
Nick drew his pistol.
"I got the treatment right here."
"That's your answer?"
May stepped in front of him.
"Kill your friends?"
"Just Lesh,"
Nick said, his voice grim and hard, even though it trembled a little, like his hand.
"Time enough to take care of Besh and Chalk when they start the twitches."
Mace still couldn't believe Nick was serious.
"You want to just shoot them?"
Nick's face had gone gray.
"Not in the head. Scatters the larvae. Some of them will be developed enough to be dangerous. To us."
"So, it's not enough that he dies."
Mace breathed Jedi discipline into a wall around his heart. To lock down his empathic horror at the gray rictus of Lesh's face. Pink-tinged foam bubbled from Lesh's lips.
"The infested areas have to be destroyed. Brain and spinal cord."
Nick nodded, looking even sicker. with wasp fever, we usually burn the body. But Mace understood. He unclipped the lightsabers from his belt, his own and Deepa's both. Green blade and purple sizzled together in the smoke-hazed air. Besh looked up from the ground. Chalk went still on the slope, the thunderbolt cradled in her arms. Nick opened his mouth as though he wanted to say something, but didn't know what it might be. They all stared at Mace as though they'd never seen him before. He's your friend. Your brother. Mace took a deep breath, steadying his own fear and revulsion, and his dark, dark loathing for what he must do. You might want to say goodbye. The Razorback Ridge eclipsed the southern sky behind them. The jungle canopy overhead glowed with early sunset. On the ground, it was already twilight. The companions walked along a broad track crushed bare by repeated passages of steamcrawler treads. What was left of Lesh was buried at the tree line. They pushed on. Nick had not spoken since a gunship attack had killed all their grassers and two of their acts. Mace matched Nick's pace, close by his side. Talk to me. Nick's eyes stayed on the jungle ahead. Why should I? Because I want to know what you have in mind.
What makes you think I have anything in mind? What makes you think anything I might have in mind can make a difference?
His voice was angrily bitter.
We have two people about to go into second stage wasp fever. No grasses, one ack, a handful of weapons, militia on our tail, and you and me.
His gaze slid sideways to meet Mace's. His eyes were red and raw.
We're dead. You get it? We didn't make it. We're dead.
For dead men, Mace observed, we're making good time.
For an instant, he thought Nick might crack a smile. Instead, Nick shook his head.
There's a Lor Pelic who travels with Deepa's band. He's very powerful. More than powerful. If we can get Besh and Chalk to him before they start the twitches, he might be able to save them.
Lor Pelic, jungle master, shaman, witch doctor, wizard. In Korin legend, the Lor Pelic was a man of great power and great peril. As unpredictable as the jungle, he brings life or death, a gift or a wound. In some stories, a Lor Pelic is not a man at all, but is rather the Pelicotan incarnate, the avatar of the jungle mind.
Mace made a connection. Kar Vastor. Nick goggled at him.
How'd you know that? How'd you know his name?
Deepa mentioned him in one of her transmissions. How long before we reach them?
Nick trudged on a few paces before he answered.
If we still had grassers and axe for warding, maybe 2 days, maybe less. On foot, with only one axe?
His shrug was expressive.
Then why march us so hard?
Mace asked.
Because I do have something in mind.
He flicked a sidelong glance at Mace.
But you're not gonna like it.
Nick's gaze went remote, staring off into the gloom-filled tunnel ahead.
There's a little outpost settlement about an hour west of here. Ones like it are strung out every 100K or so along these steamcrawler tracks. They'll have a secure bunker and a comm unit. Even though we, the ULF, don't use comm, we still monitor the frequencies. We get in there, we can send a coded signal to them with our position. Then, we put Chalk and Besh in phenatazine suspension, sit tight, and hope for the best.
A Balawai settlement?
Nick nodded. Mace's face darkened.
I won't let you harm civilians, not even to save your friends.
No need to scorch your scalp over that one,
Nick said, trudging onward.
Out here, civilians are a myth.
From the private journals of Mace Windu.
In this bunker, the air is closer to cool than any I've felt since the interrogation room in the Ministry of Justice. The bunker is set into the igneous stone of the hillside, mostly just a durasteel door across the mouth of a bubble some pocket of gas or softer stone had left in the granite here. Though it overlooks the remnants of the outpost compound below, it was clearly never meant to be a combat position, no gun ports. From the way it's constructed, excavated, I believe it was more along the lines of a panic room, a safe place to hole up in the event of an attack, a safe place to wait for help from the militia. If so, it didn't work. The night air gently curls around the twisted shards that are all that's left of the door. Its whispering passage darkly echoes the violence that still hums in the force around me. I dare not meditate. The dark is too deep here. It has a tidal pull, a black hole that I've taken up too tight an orbit around, and it's tearing me in half. Gravity draws the near half of me in toward an event horizon, which I'm afraid to even glimpse. Behind me, lost in the night shadows against the stone, Besh and Chalk lie motionless, near as cool as the rock they lie on, in full thanatazine suspension. Only with the force can I tell that they still live. Their hearts beat less than once per minute, and an hour spans no more than 10 or 12 shallow breaths. The fever wasp larvae in their bodies are similarly suspended. Besh and Chalk might survive a week or more like this. The thunderbolt rests on its bipod in the doorway, muzzle canted toward the sky. There is little for me to do right now. I pass the time by recording this and by thinking about my argument with Nick. Back on the trail, Nick said that civilians are a myth. He meant, I found, that there are no civilians out here, that to be in the jungle is to be in the war. The Balawai government promulgates a myth of innocent jungle prospectors being massacred by savage Koronai partisans. This, Nick says, is only propaganda. According to Nick, civilians stay in the cities. The only real civilians on Harun Kaul are the waiters and the janitors, the storekeepers and the taxi cart pullers. Then I asked him about the dead children. It's the only time I've yet seen Nick angry. He wheeled on me like he wanted to throw a punch. "What children?" he said. "How old do you have to be to pull a trigger? Kids make great soldiers. They barely know what fear is." It is wrong to make war on children or with them, and I told them so. No matter what, they're not old enough to understand the consequences of their actions. He replied in staggeringly obscene terms that I should tell that to the Balawai. It has occurred to me on reflection that Nick Rostu can be regarded as a test of my moral conviction. A Jedi might conceivably fall to the dark from the simple desire to smack the stuffing out of him. At the time, I managed to restrain myself, and even to maintain a civil tone, while Nick revealed that he knew all about the jungle massacre and the data crystal. It wasn't easy. He told me that not only had he been there, at the very scene Yoda and I had seen in Palpatine's office, he had been in the company of Deepa and Carvaster when they'd thought the whole scheme up. He had helped them dress the scene, and later it was Nick himself who had tipped off Republic Intelligence. Even now, hours later, it's hard for me to put into words how that made me feel. Disoriented, certainly. Almost dizzy. Disbelieving. Betrayed. It is as well that Nick left on Chalk's Ak-Dog Galthra some hours ago. Perhaps before he returns, if he returns, I will have found a place in my mind to put these things he shared with me, where they will no longer whisper violence behind my heart. The whole massacre was staged. Not fake. The bodies were real. The death was real. But it was a setup. It was a practical joke. On me. Deepa wanted me here. That's what this had been about, from the beginning. That data crystal wasn't a frame, and it wasn't a confession. It was a lure. She wanted to draw me from Coruscant, bring me to Harun Kaul, and drop me into this nightmare jungle. Many of the corpses were indeed jungle prospectors, Nick told me. Jups, when they're not harvesting the jungle, act as irregulars for the Balawai militia. The rest of the corpses in that staged little scene, they were Koronai prisoners, captured by the Jups. Captured, and tortured, and maltreated beyond my ability to describe. When the ULF caught up, the first thing the Balawai did was execute the few prisoners who were still alive. Nick tells me that none of them escaped, none of the prisoners, and none of the Japs. The children. The children were Koronai. This Carvaster, what kind of man must he be? Nick told me it was Carvaster who nailed that data crystal into the dead woman's mouth with brass vine thorns. Nick told me it was Carvaster who persuaded the ULF to leave the corpses in the jungle, to make the scene so gruesome that I'd be sure to come here to investigate. To leave dead children, their own dead children, to the Jacunas and the screw maggots, and the black, stinking carrion flies so full of blood they can only waddle across rotting flesh. Stop! I have to stop. Stop talking about this. Stop thinking about it. I can't. This isn't. I'm afraid that the man I was would despise the man I am becoming. I have a terrible dread that this transformation is exactly what Deepa had in mind when she decided to draw me here. She said, "There is nothing more dangerous than a Jedi who's finally gone sane." I think she is dangerous. I'm afraid she wants me to become dangerous, too. Nick says the words on that crystal are just how Deepa talks now. He says she has nightmares, that screams from her tent tear through the camp. He says no one ever sees her eat, that she's wasting away as though something inside is instead eating her. He says she has headaches that painkillers cannot touch, and sometimes cannot leave her tent for days at a time. I'm sorry I asked. I'm sorry that Nick told me. I'm sorry that he did not lie. It is very un-Jedi to fear the truth. I'll continue the story. Putting experience into words is a gain in perspective, which I need, and it's a way to pass the hours of the night, which I also need. This outpost settlement was built at the crest of a shoulder sloping down from the ridge. The ridge here isn't a razorback anymore, but rather a sine wave wall of volcanic mounds. The settlement stands on a green-splashed outcrop. To either side of this jungle-clutched fist of stone are blackened washes where lava occasionally flows down from a major caldera, which is about 600 meters above where I sit and record this. If you listen closely, you might hear the rumble. This microphone may not be sensitive enough. There. Hear that? It's ramping up for another eruption. The bunker itself is slightly elevated above the rest of the compound. From where I sit, in the wreckage of the doorway, I can look down over a charred mass of tumbled and broken prefab huts and the shattered perimeter wall. Pale glowvine light shows gray on the steam crawler track that switchbacks up the side of the shoulder. The ULF had been here already. There were no survivors. Based on the limited scavenger damage and the low decomposition, Nick guessed that the ULF band who'd done this might have passed through here no more than 2 or 3 days before. The ULF guerrillas also thoroughly looted this place. There was not a scrap of food to be found, and only useless bits and pieces of technology and equipment. The comm gear is gone as well, of course, which is why I alone am here to watch over Besh and Chalk. When we found the comm gear gone, Nick's spirits collapsed. Bad luck, he muttered under his breath. Just bad luck. Luck, I told him softly, does not exist. Luck is only a word we use to describe our blindness to the subtle currents of the Force. His response was bitter. Yeah? What subtle current killed Lesh? Is this what your Force had planned for you? For Besh and Chalk? The Jedi say, I replied, that there are questions to which we can never have answers. We can only be answers. He asked me angrily what that was supposed to mean. I told him, I am neither a scientist nor a philosopher. I am a Jedi. I don't have to explain reality. I just have to deal with it. He said, you have a Jedi power that can get all of us to Deepa and Kar in a day, or three. They're marching away from us. We can't catch up. That's reality. the only one there is it? I let a thoughtful gaze rest on Gothra's broad back. She moves well through this jungle. I know that axes are not beasts of burden, but one man, alone, she might be able to carry at great speed. Well, yeah, if I didn't have to worry about you guys. Nick stopped, his eyes narrowed. Not a chance, not a chance, Windu. Drop it. I stepped close to him. Nick had to bend his neck to look up into my eyes. I'm not arguing with you, Nick, and I'm not asking you. This is not a discussion. It's a briefing. Nick is a stubborn young man, but he's not stupid. It didn't take him long to understand that until he met me, he didn't know what stubborn looks like. We managed to rig an improvised bareback pad for Gothra. Nick and Chalk and I persuaded Gothra, through the force, to bear Nick on her back and carry him swiftly through the jungle on the trail of the departed Koronai. The three of us watched them vanish into the living night. Then, Besh and Chalk arranged themselves as comfortably as possible on the bunker floor, and I injected them with thanatazine. We all wait together, in hopes that Nick will win through the jungle, in hopes that he might find and bring back this Kar Vastor, this dangerous Lor Pelek, this terror of the living and mutilator of the dead, and that this man of no conscience or human feeling might use his power to save two lives. All I feel is the jungle and the dark. The eruption seems to be strengthening. And rain has begun, as it often will, triggered by particulates in the smoke plume. Speaking of smoke... Wait, that sounded like... Oh no, that's basic. Those are screams. There are children out there.
Mace pelted downslope, running half-blind through rain and smoke and steam, navigating by ear, heading for the screams. Mace threw himself into the forest, letting it carry him, bounding from rock to branch to rock, flipping high over crevices, slipping past black-shadowed tree trunks and under low branches with millimeters to spare. The voices came intermittently, in between, through the downpour and the eruption and the hammering of his own heart. Mace heard a grinding of steel on stone and the mechanical thunder of an engine pushed to the outer limits of its power. It was a steam crawler. It lay canted at a dangerous angle over a precipice, only a lip of rock preventing a fall into bottomless darkness. One track clanked on air. The other was buried in hardening lava. Though steam crawlers are low-tech, to reduce their vulnerability to the metal-eating fungi, they are far from primitive. A kilometer below the caldera, the lava flow didn't come close to the melting point of the advanced alloys that made up the steam crawler's armor and treads. But lava was filling in the gap below its flat undercarriage, until the only real question was whether the rising lava would topple the steam crawler over the lip before enough heat conducted through its armor to roast whoever was inside. But not everyone was inside. Mace skidded to a stop just a meter upslope of where the flow had cut the track. The lava had slashed through the ground to bedrock, making the edge of the gully where Mace stood into an unstable dirt cliff 8 meters high above a sluggish river of molten stone. The steam crawler was a further 10 meters down to his right. Its immense headlamps threw a white glare into the steam and the rain. Mace could just barely make out two small forms huddled together on the highest point, the rear corner of the cabin's heavily canted roof. Another crawled through the yellow-lit oblong of an open side hatch and joined them. Three terrified children sobbing on the cabin roof. In the force, Mace could feel two more inside, one injured, in pain that was transforming into shock, the other unconscious. A new tremor from the eruption shook the dirt cliff under his feet. He felt it sag. Undercut by the river of lava, the shaking was rapidly destroying the cliff's structural integrity. Any second now, it would collapse, sending Mace down into the river, unless he did something first. The something he did was to reach deep through the forest until he could feel the dirt cliff's shatter point, a structure of broken rock 10 meters below him and 5 meters in from the face. He thought, why wait? and shoved. The dirt cliff shook, buckled, and collapsed. With a subterranean roar that buried even the thunder of the eruption and the clamor of the steam crawler's laboring engine, hundreds of tons of dirt and rock poured into the river of lava, organics bursting into flames that the growing landslide instantly smothered as it built itself into a huge wedge-shaped berm of raw ground across the gully. As lava slowly bulged and climbed the upstream face, the downstream side of the cliff continued to collapse, piling over cooler lava that hardened beneath it, pushing the hotter, more liquid lava into a wave that washed around the steam crawler's side, well to the lip of the precipice, then plunged in a rain of fire upon the black jungle far below. The landslide built into a wave of its own that filled in the gully as it rolled down toward the steam crawler and the screaming, sobbing children. And on the very crest of that wave of dirt and rock, backpedaling furiously to keep from being sucked under by the landslide's roll, came Mace Windu. Mace rode that crest, while the wave sank and flattened and finally lurched to a halt, its last remnants trickling into a ridge that joined Mace's position with the corner of the steam crawler's cabin. Nearly all his concentration stayed submerged in the force, spread throughout the slide, using a wide-focus force grip to stabilize the rubble while he scrambled down to the steam crawler's roof. On the roof were two young boys, both about six, and a girl of perhaps 8 standard years. They clung to each other, sobbing, terror-filled eyes staring through their tears. Mace squatted beside them and touched the girl's arm.
"My name is Mace Windu. I need your help."
The girl sniffled in astonishment.
My help?"
Mace nodded gravely.
"I need you to help me get these boys to safety. Can you do that? Can you take the boys up the same way I came down? Climb right up the crest. It's not steep."
I'm afraid."
Mace leaned close and spoke in her ear, only a little louder than the hush of the rain.
"Me too. But you have to act brave. Pretend, so you don't scare the little boys. Okay?"
"Okay,"
she said dubiously. But she wiped her eyes and took a deep breath. And when she turned to the other two children, her voice had the bossy edge that seems to be the exclusive weapon of 8-year-old girls.
"Erno, Nykel, come on! Quit crying, you big babies! I'm going to save us!"
As the girl bullied the two boys up onto the face of the slide, Mace moved on to the hatchway. Inside, the crawler's floor was sharply tilted, and the rain pounding through the open hatchway slickened the floor until it was impossible to climb. Down at the lowermost corner of the rectangular cabin, a boy who seemed to be barely into his teens struggled one-handed to drag a girl not much younger up the steep floor. He had a foamy wad of blood-soaked spray bandage around one upper arm, and he was trying to shove the unconscious girl ahead of him, using the riveted Durasteel leg posts of the crawler seats like a ladder. Mace leaned in through the hatchway and extended his hand.
"All right, son, just take my hand. Once we get you out of here, then I can..."
When the boy looked up, the tearful appeal on his face twisted into instant wild rage, and his plea became a fierce shriek. Mace hadn't noticed the swing-stock blaster rifle slung around his good arm. The first hint of its existence Mace got was a burst of hot bolts past his face. He threw himself backward out the hatch and flattened against the cabin wall while the hatchway vomited blaster fire. The steam crawler lurched, the hatch going even higher. His sudden movement had been enough to tip its precarious balance, toppling it toward the precipice. Mace bared his teeth to the night. With the force, he seized the steam crawler and yanked it back into place. But a squeal from above grabbed his attention. In seizing the crawler, he'd lost his force hold on the landslide, and the unstable mound of dirt and rock had begun to shift under the little girl and the two boys, sending them sliding down toward the lava. Mace calmed his hammering heart and extended one hand. He had to close his eyes for a moment to reassert his control on the slide and stabilize it, but its shift had left it less solid than before. He could hold it for the minute or two it would take the girl and boys to reach the relative safety of the outcrop above, not much more. And now he could feel the crawler slowly tilting beneath him, leaning higher and higher toward the point of no return. From inside the cabin, he could hear the boy's terrified curses and his shrieks about, "Kill all you fragging cornos!" Mace's eyes drifted closed. This filthy war. The boy and the girl in the steam crawler were about to become casualties because when the boy had looked up, he could not see that the Jedi Master had come to his rescue. He could see only a Corrin. To use the Force to disarm the boy or persuade him would break the hold he kept upon the landslide, which might cost the lives of the three children scrambling up its face. To reason with the boy seemed impossible. The boy would know too much about what Balawai can expect at the hands of Corrinai, and it would certainly take longer than they had. To abandon them was not an option. "Kid," Mace called, roughening his voice, making himself sound the way the boy would expect a Corrin to sound, adopting a thick upland accent like Chalk's. "Kid, 5 seconds to toss that blaster out the hatch and come after it, you got."
"Never," the boy screamed from inside. "Never."
"Don't come out, you. And the next thing you see, the last thing you see ever, is a grenade coming in. Hear me, you?"
"Go ahead. I know what happens if we get taken alive."
"Kid, already got the others, don't I? The girl, Erno and Nykel. Gonna lead them all alone, you? With me?"
There came a pause. Mace said into the silence,
"Sure, go ahead and die. Any coward can do that. Guts enough to live for a while, you got."
He was moderately sure that a 13-year-old boy who'd load up 4 other children and set out in a steam crawler across the Coronel Highland at night, a boy who'd rather die than leave an unconscious girl behind, had guts enough for just about anything. A second later, he was proved right.
From the private journals of Mace Windu.
"From this doorway, I can see a spray of brilliant white flares. Headlamps of 4 steam crawlers climbing the spine of the fold, heading for the broken track. Heading for us. Dawn will come in an hour. I hope we'll all live that long. The eruptions have subsided, and the rain has trailed off to an intermittent patter. We've shifted some things around in the bunker. The 3 younger children are curled up on scavenged blankets in the back, asleep. Besh and Chalk now lie near the Thunderbolt, where I can keep an eye on them. I'm not at all sure that one of these children might not try to do them some harm. Terrell, a boy of 13 who seems to be their natural leader, is remarkably fierce, and he still does not entirely believe that I'm not planning to torture all 5 of them to death. I wonder what Nick would say about these civilians. Are they a myth, too? I can't consider such questions right now. Right now, all I seem to be able to do is stare past the twisted jags of durasteel that once had been this bunker's door, watching the steam crawlers upward creep. I don't need any hints from the Force to have a bad feeling about this. In Dejarik, there is a classic maneuver called the Fork, where a player moves a single hollow monster into position to attack 2 or more of his opponents, so that no matter which monster the opponent moves to safety, the other will be eaten. Caught in the Fork, one's only choice is which piece to lose. The word has come to symbolize situations where the only choice to be made is a choice of disasters. We are well and truly forked. I know who these steam crawlers are bringing. Jungle prospectors from the same outpost as the children, fleeing the same ULF guerrillas whose attack had forced the children away. Probably the same band that destroyed this outpost. I got the story from Terrell while I was tending to his broken arm and the girl's scalp wound. Terrell's arm had been broken by either a bullet or a grenade fragment. He wasn't sure which. The older girl, Keela, has the most serious injury. In the steam crawler's tumble down the gully, she had been thrown from her seat. She has a skull fracture and a severe concussion. The younger children, Erno and Nykel, and the brave little girl Pell, have nothing worse than a few bruises and scraped hands and knees from scrambling up the landslide. I have not bothered to maintain my pretense of belonging to the guerrillas. though I have also avoided explaining who I really am. The children seem to have decided that I'm a bounty hunter, since I don't act like a Corno, which is to say, I haven't tortured and killed them, as they were all half expecting, based on the tales they've heard from their parents. I have not disabused them of this notion. It's easier to believe than the truth. The line of steam crawlers has halted half a kilometer below us, where the lava wash has taken out the track. This won't stop them for long. When the cliff collapsed, it made a natural dam across the break. It seems I have no choices left. Surrender is not an option. To save Besh and Chalk, not to mention myself, I'll have to hold the children hostage. This is how far I've fallen. Even I, a Jedi Master. This is what a few days in this war has brought me to, threatening the lives of children I would give my own to save. And if these Balawai call my bluff, the best outcome I can then foresee, these children will have to watch as their parents or their parents' friends are killed by a Jedi. Glow rods below. They've left the steam crawlers and are advancing on foot. There are a lot of them.
These Balawai may have been irregulars, but they were both experienced and disciplined. Their recon squad entered the ruined compound in three teams of two, spread over 120 degrees of arc to give them overlapping fields of fire. While glow rods still waved halfway along the slope below, these six entered in total silence and deep shadow. They must have had some kind of night vision equipment. If the Force hadn't let Mace feel the stark threat of their weapons' points of aim, he wouldn't have known they were there.
"Terrell," he said softly, "they're here. Go ahead, son."
"You sure? I can't see anything," Terrell said from beside him.
"They will be able to see you," Mace said. "Call out."
"Okay."
Staying in the shadows, he repeated okay, but this time in a loud call.
"Okay. Hey, don't shoot, okay? Don't shoot, it's me."
The night went silent. Mace felt six weapons trained on the bunker door. He murmured,
"Tell them who you are."
"Yeah, hey, listen, it's Terrell, huh? Terrell Nakai. Is my dad out there?"
A woman's voice came out of the darkness to Mace's left, shrill with hope.
"Terrell, oh my God, Terrell, is Keela with you?"
The girl with the head wound held Pell and the two boys well back from the doorway. But when she heard the woman's voice, she started unsteadily to her feet.
"Mom, I'm here. I'm okay. Keela, oh my God, is Pell with you?"
A man shouted from the center.
"Quiet!"
"Rankin, it's Terrell and Keela. Didn't you hear them? Keela, what about Pell?"
"Hold your damn position and shut up," the man snarled.
His voice was ragged, angry, exhausted, and desperate.
"They could be bait. Shut your hole before I shoot you myself."
Mace nodded to himself. He would have suspected the same thing.
"Terrell?"
The man called out in a much softer tone, wearily calm.
"Terrell, it's Peck Rankin. Come on out here where we can see you."
Terrell looked at Mace.
"Go on then," Mace said gently. "Move slowly. Keep your hands in plain sight, away from your body."
Terrell did.
"Can somebody put on a light? I can't see."
"In a minute,"
Rankin's voice replied from the darkness.
"Just keep walking toward my voice. Are you alone? Where are the other kids?"
"In the bunker, but they can't come out," Terrell said. "And you can't go in."
"Why's that?"
Mace said, "Because I'm in here."
In the Force, he felt their tension ratchet up, sharp as an indrawn breath. After a moment, Rankin's voice came out of the darkness.
"And who might you be?"
"You don't need to know."
"Is that so? Why don't you step out where we can get a look at you?"
"Because
the temptation to take a shot at me might prove overwhelming. Any bolts that miss will be bouncing around the inside of this bunker, where there are four more innocent children."
A new man's voice rang out from the right, thin with fear and anger.
"Two of those kids are my sons. If you hurt them..."
All I have done, May said, is tend their injuries and keep them sheltered. What happens to them now depends on you.
He's telling the truth, Terrell called. He didn't hurt us. He saved us. He's okay, really. He's just afraid you'll shoot him because he's a corno.
A burst of low, half-strangled profanity came from the right. Terrell called hastily.
But he's not a real corno. He just looks like one. He talks almost like a regular balawai, and he's like a bounty hunter or something.
His voice trickled off, leaving a silence empty and ominous. Finally, Rankin called out once more.
So, what do you want?
I want you to take these children and go away from here.
Huh? What else?
That's all. Just take the children and go.
Well, aren't you generous? Rankin said, dry, bitter. Listen, I'm gonna make a light. Nobody get twitchy. I don't want to get fragged, okay?
Yellow-white glow flared behind a slab of tumbled wall, and a cell-powered glow rod came flipping through the air to land not far from Terrell's feet. Terrell held a hand at his chin to shade his eyes.
Hey, don't make me stand around alone out here, huh?
Come on over here, boy.
A man stepped into view, moving slowly into the light. He held a blaster rifle in one hand, its barrel slanting down, carefully directed at the ground beside him. From his voice, this was Rankin.
Get yourself under cover.
Terrell looked back up at the bunker. May said,
Go ahead, son.
The voice of the man who claimed to be the boy's father snarled from the darkness.
Don't call him son, Corno. You're not his father. Your stinking kind killed his father. Stow that crap,
Rankin barked, but too late. Terrell's face crumpled in tragic disbelief.
Dad?
He said, sounding stunned and lost.
My dad?
If eyes could shoot blaster bolts, Rankins would have killed the man.
Get him out of here, he said.
Another man, also wounded, stepped far enough into the light to fold Terrell in his arms and draw him away into the ring of darkness.
Listen, Rankin said, looking up at the dark, jagged mouth of the bunker. Those crawlers are stuffed with wounded, and we've got a cartload of cornos on our tails. We can't just go, get it? We can't. We need a place to hole up till dawn, that's all.
You can't stay here, May said. There are ULF guerrillas on their way here right now. Look at where you are. This place couldn't stand against them when it was intact.
You know what happened here?
Rankin waved his rifle at the shattered huts.
Where is everybody?
Dead, May said. Killed by the ULF. All of them.
I don't think so. Where are the bodies? Think I've never seen a ULF action? I know the kind of things they do to our dead.
Forget the bodies.
Mace had buried them all. He tried to massage the pain from his temple with the heel of one hand.
If you're here when the gorillas arrive, they'll kill all of you, too. You care about your children's lives? Get them out of here.
Some kind of stinking funny corno,
the father's voice said from the shadows.
What's he so worried about us for? Didn't I tell you to shut up?
Rankin snapped.
You're asking us to take a lot on faith from some guy we can't even see.
You don't need to see me. All you need is to see this.
With a twitch of the force, Mace squeezed the Thunderbolt's trigger. A single packet of plasma screamed into the sky and burst in a spherical flash of scarlet as it entered a low cloud.
That could as easily have been your head. I know exactly where you are. All six of you.
He paused for a second to let that sink in.
If I wanted you hurt, we wouldn't be talking. You'd already be dead.
The truth of this wiped Rankin's face clean of expression. Mace watched it hit home and had just enough time to think that this might actually work. Then, streaks of blaster fire lit up the slope below. The jungle thundered with scarlet explosions, multiple bolts flashing from the cover of steam crawlers to shatter branches and blow rocks to splinters. The bursts were instantly echoed by smaller, wider flares under the trees, crackling like a bonfire built of green logs. Muzzle flashes. Slug throwers.
Rankin!
The force gave Mesa's voice the thunder of a signal cannon.
Pull your people back! A fighting retreat! Have them pull back here to the compound!
You said coming up here can't help us.
It can't. I can. Do it. It's your only chance. Behind Mace, one of the boys had started to cry, and now the other one joined him. Outside, Rankin was shouting into his comlink.
No, damn it, up here. Flares and flame projectors. Light them up and slow them down. And get those crawlers in gear.
A star burst to life below and shot high into the air. A flare. It hung below the clouds, lighting the steam crawlers, the jungle, and the outpost stark actinic white. Mace had to shield his eyes against the sudden glare, and he heard the father's harsh cry of triumph, and the force snapped his lightsaber to his hand and brought the blade to life as a blaster rifle sang a rhythm fast as a hand could squeeze. The father was no marksman. No bolt would have come within arm's length of Mace, but they would have bounced into the bunker. Amethyst energy flashed to meet the red, and instead, every bolt screamed away into the sky. Mace stood in the doorway, looking down at Rankin's awestruck face past the guard angle of his lightsaber's blade. Rankin's mouth moved in breathless silence.
Jedi!
Keela, Mace said without turning, his voice tight but dead level. Get the children to the back. Lie down behind the bodies of the Koronai. They are your best cover.
What?
Keela stared at him blankly.
Who are you?
From outside, the father's voice roared.
That's a Jedi!
And an instant later, it was joined by another voice, higher, half-broken, hoarse with grief, betrayal, and wild rage.
A stinking Jedi! He's a stinking Jedi! Kill him! Kill him!
The voice was Terrell's. The Force moved Mace's hands faster than thought. Deepa's lightsaber went to his left hand to mirror his own in his right. And together, they wove a wall across the mouth of the bunker, catching and scattering a flood of blaster fire. Mace sank deeper and deeper into the Force, surrendering more and more of his conscious thought to instinctive world of the Vapad. And even so, some bolts slipped past him and whanged randomly around the inside of the bunker. He was aware, in an abstract, disconnected way, of an ache in his arms and the salt sting of sweat trickling into his eyes. He was aware of hot slashes of blaster grazes along his flanks and of a chunk that had been torn from one thigh by a glancing hit. All these meant less to him than the new vectors of fire as he continued his relentless march and the Jups broke from cover. He was also aware that not all the Jups were shooting. He heard Rankin's desperate orders to cease fire and felt in the Force an irrational blood hunger that kept the others squeezing triggers until their weapons began to smoke. A blood hunger fed by the dark. No, not blood hunger. Blood fever. The dark power he had felt gather in the Force now rose around him to swallow the stars. It broke over him in a wave that pushed him down and caught him up. And when he felt a hostile presence lunge toward his back, he whirled with effortless speed, and amethyst plasma splashed fire through the long durasteel blade of a knife held in a small hand. A sliced-off piece skittered across the ground, and green energy dropped like an axe for the kill. And stopped, trembling, 1 centimeter above a brown-haired head. Brown hairs curled, crisp, and blackened in green fire. A stub of knife, its new-cut edge still glowing hot, dropped from a nerveless hand. Stunned brown eyes, streaming tears that sparkled with brilliant green highlights, stared up at him from either side of Deepa's blade.
Stinking Jedi,
Terrell sobbed.
Go on and kill me! Go on and kill everybody!
You're not safe out here, Mace said. He threw himself backward, and with a shove of the Force, sent Terrell skidding toward the door of the bunker. Mace rolled to his feet, blades angled defensively before him, looking up at the looming turret gun of a steam crawler as it traversed to track him. Someone inside had decided it would be worth Terrell's life to take out Mace. Mace didn't much care for that kind of math. He had a different equation in mind. 4 steam crawlers divided by 1 Jedi equals a huge, smoking pile of scrap. The shatter points of the crawlers were obvious, Neither the linked treads nor the traverse gears that rotated the turrets would stand against a single swipe of a lightsaber. In less than a second apiece, he could turn these armored behemoths into nothing more than hollow metal rocks. But he didn't. Because that wouldn't hurt enough. He wanted to hurt them worse than this black migraine was hurting him. These people had attacked him when all he wanted was to help them. When he had been trying to save them. They had attacked him without regard for their own lives or the lives of their children. They'd almost made him kill one of their children himself. They were stupid. They were evil. They deserved to be punished. They deserved to die. He was already running toward the steam crawler, gathering himself for the headlong dive when he finally thought, "What am I doing?" He barely managed to turn his dive into a spring instead. He flipped upward through the air to land poised on the steam crawler's outer deck beside the flame gun turret. He let himself fall prone to the deck, using its bulk to cover him against blaster fire from the balawai on the ground, and his whole body sagged as he tried to pull his mind back out from the force. It was too dark here. Fatigue and pain rushed him, barreling him toward unconsciousness. Drawing upon the force to sustain himself drew in rage as well. He clung to the crawler's deck, pressing his face into the hot, bullet-scarred armor. Every second he could hold himself still was another second for some of these men and women to live. The axe came up from the jungle, climbing the steep lava-cut sides of the outcrop, massive claws gouging furrows in the stone. 5, 8, a dozen gigantic armored cowl spines bristling in full threat display. White foamy ropes of slaver looping from the corners of their dagger-toothed mouths. Heavily armed balawai fell back before them. The axe moved with the deliberate speed of creatures who have nothing to fear. When they reached the crown of the outcrop, they began to pace around the outpost perimeter, circling the shattered huts. Their pace became a trot, then a gallop, a ring of armored predator, gradually tightening. Mace recognized axe herding behavior. As though the balawai were unruly grassers, the axe were forcing them into a single crowd in the central common area of the compound like a corral, working by pure intimidation. Mace felt the dark thunder rising in the forest, and he knew the compound hadn't become a corral. It had become a slaughter pen, a killing ground. And then he felt the shadow of the butcher. Mace looked upslope. There he was, standing on the rock above the bunker's door. A Quarren. In the force, he burned with power. Huge. His sweat-glistening bare chest could have been fused together from granite boulders. His shaven skull gleamed more than 2 meters above his bare feet. His pants were crudely sewn from a vine cat's pelt. He raised arms like a skyscraper's buttresses over his head. To each forearm was strapped some kind of shield, elongated teardrops of a mirror-polished metal. Their wide curved ends extended around his massive fists, and they tapered to needle points, a handspan behind his elbows. Mace knew him now. This must be the Lor Pelek. This was Kar Vastar. His arms swept downward. And from beyond the ring of circling axe leaped 6 Koronai, springing high as Jedi, but without Jedi grace. The force thrust that propelled them felt like a grunt of pain. They flailed as though they clawed their way through the air, but they landed coiled, balanced, crouched to attack. All 6 were dressed identically to Vastar, and each bore those twin teardrop shields that snarled like overdriven comm speakers. The balawai met them with a storm of blaster fire. Bolts flashed and splattered and splintered upward into the clouds as the twin shields each man bore moved faster than thought. On the rock above, the Lor Pelek spread his corded arms, leaning out over the top, toppling as though he thought he could fly. Then, at the last instant, he sprang forward into a dive that carried him toward the center of the crowd of balawai, where they massed around the steam crawlers. The Koronai waded in without waiting for Vastar to land. They sprang among the mass of balawai and swung those teardrop shields in short, vicious arcs, angled flat as though to cut with their edges. And cut they did. Their sizzling edges bit through blasters with tooth-grinding squeals. They slashed through flesh with a meaty squelch, and the blood on them shivered to mist. Scarlet clouds trailed them like smoke. Mace saw a man cut in half, and the shield came out his other side, still shining like an ultra-chrome mirror. Shining like a vibro-axe. Vaster touched down in the middle of the compound and rolled out of his fall without slowing. He flashed into an inhumanly fast sprint toward the very steam crawler atop which Mace lay. Vaster's sprint became a headlong dive that carried him sliding between the treads. The steam crawler's armor hummed under Mace's hands, and a harsher squeal joined the chorus of snarling shields. He had to bite back an obscenity he'd learned from Nick. Vaster was cutting through the crawler's undercarriage. Had he stolen that dark dream right out of Mace's head? Mace popped to his feet, and both his lightsabers hummed to life. He felt Vaster in the Force, a torch that flared with darkness. He was almost through the undercarriage. Once inside, he'd be loose among the wounded. Mace decided it was time he introduced himself to this Lor Pelek. He sprang into the air, flipping high over the steam crawler's turret to land on its flat mid-deck armor directly above Vaster. A vibro shield is not the only thing that can cut steam crawler armor. A disc of that armor, edges still glowing from the lightsaber's cuts, Mace still kneeling in its center, dropped straight down like a free-falling turbo lift. Mace heard one explosive obscenity from below, before he and the disc of armor flattened Carvaster like a fusion-powered pile driver. The interior of the steam crawler was crowded with wounded men and women. Vaster lay pinned, face down to the deck, half stunned. Mace leaned close to his ear. Carvaster, I am Mace Windu. Stand down. That's an order. A twitch of the Force was his only warning. But for Mace, it was more than he needed. He threw himself into a backflip a quarter of a second before the disc of armor slammed upward to smash against the ceiling with a deafening clank. Before it could fall again, Vaster was on his feet. Vaster faced Mace across the hole Vaster had cut in the undercarriage. Darkness pulsed at Mace through the Force, but on the Lor Pelek's face was not anger, but instead, inhuman focus. A primal ferocity like a crate dragon surprised over the corpse of a bantha. He raised his shield-clad hands in salute and rumbled something in a language that Mace didn't recognize. It didn't even sound like language at all. More like the growls and snarls of jungle beasts. But as Vaster spoke, some power of the Lor Pelek unfurled his meaning inside Mace's mind.
Mace Windu, an honor. Why do you interfere in my kill?
There is no kill, Mace said. Do you understand me? No kill. No more killing.
Vaster's smile was disbelieving.
No? Then what do you propose? Shall we lay down our arms?
He beckoned invitingly with one sizzling shield.
You first.
No unnecessary killing, Mace amended. No more massacres.
Massacres are necessary, Doshalo.
You and I are not Doshalai.
Mace angled his lightsabers in a defensive X.
You are no clan brother of mine.
These will keep, Doshalo. They cannot escape. Follow me.
With a rush of the Force, he sprang straight upward through the hole Mace had cut. That same rush of the Force tugged at Mace's will, inclining him to follow without thinking. But he understood now the power of this place, and of Vaster himself.
You'll have to do better than that, Mace muttered.
He turned his attention to the terrified Balawai around him. He gestured, and all the discarded blasters flipped from the deck to hang in midair. With a single swift flourish, he sliced every one of them in half, then cast their pieces out the hole.
Listen to me, all of you. You must surrender. It is your only hope.
Hope of what? A man said bitterly. We know what happens if we're captured.
Not this time, May said. If you fight, they will kill you. If you surrender, I can keep you alive. And I will.
We're supposed to just take your word for it?
I'm a Jedi Master. The man spat blood on the deck.
We know what that's worth. I won't argue. Mace moved to the rim of the hole Vastor had cut, and looked up through the one he'd cut himself, judging his clearance. Fight to a sure death, or surrender to a hope of life? The choice is yours, he said, and threw himself upward into the burning night. The entire compound was on fire. Choking black smoke swirled above blazing lakes of flame projector fuel. Vastor bounded up the slope toward the bunker in erratic zigzagging leaps, his shields flashing, catching stray bolts, carving metal, slashing flesh. Mace dove from the top of the steam crawler, flipped in the air, and hit the ground running. His blades wove a green and purple corona of power that splintered blaster fire into the sky. Mace didn't trouble with the distraction that had made Vastor's path jag like a bolt of lightning. He went straight for the door's shattered gape, as though launched from a cannon. He reached it only steps behind the larger man, and froze. Froze despite the chilling whine of those teardrop shields, despite Vastor's rumbling snarl like the hunting cough of a hungry vine cat. Despite a sound Mace could no more ignore than he could reverse the rotation of the planet. The shrieks of children screaming in terror. Vastor stood within, hunched like a gundark, his right arm drawn back to strike. Dangling from hair tangled in Vastor's left fist, feet kicking above the floor, sobbing uncontrollably about how all you stinking cornos have to die, was Terrell.
Vastor, stop!
Mace opened himself to the full flood of the force and used it to hammer at the Lor Pelic's will.
Don't do it, Carr. Put the boy down.
He might as well have not bothered. Vastor's answering snarl translated in Mace's mind as,
when I am done with him.
The shield strapped to Vastor's left arm made a mirrored halo over Terrell's head. But now, the other angled toward where Besh and Chalk lay.
Look there, and see what sort of creature I hold.
He's not some creature, Mace responded, with reflexive certainty. He's a boy. His name is...
Mace's voice trailed away as his eyes finally made sense of what Vastor was pointing at.
Terrell.
Besh and Chalk lay on the stone floor midway between where Vastor stood holding Terrell and where Keela, Pell, and the two younger boys cowered. The clothing of the thanatazine-bound Coronai appeared inexplicably rumpled, even tattered. And over their torsos, it glistened a wet, oily black. A full second passed before Mace realized that it was the light from his blades that robbed color from the wet gleam on their clothes. He figured it out by the smell, strong, even through the reek of the burning compound outside. It was the smell of blood. Someone had been hacking, inexpertly, but with considerable enthusiasm, at the two helpless Coronai. They had lain down in this cold bunker floor and taken into their veins the drug that had swallowed them in a false death, trusting that a Jedi Master would watch over them to prevent a real one. On the floor below Terrell's dangling feet was a short stub of knife, smeared with the same dark blood. The blade was only half a decimeter long, its tip now a sharp, straight slant. Terrell's knife. The one Mace had sliced in half on the slope outside. Strength drained from Mace's knees.
Oh, Terrell, he said, letting his lightsabers swallow their blades.
Terrell, what have you done?
Don't worry. He won't do it again.
Mace could only roar a futile denial as Vastor struck. The vibro shield sank deep into Terrell's body. And as the Lor Pelic ripped the life out of the boy, the blood fever told Mace what he should have done differently. He should have killed Carr Vastor. Mace drew back both lightsabers and whipped them forward and down with the full grim intention to carve Vastor into pieces so small it would take a bioscan to tell they'd ever been human. The Lor Pelic cast aside the boy's corpse with one flick of his massive wrist and whirled, shields flashing in the lightsaber glare as they flicked upward and met Mace's downward strokes. Mace used the force to drive the blades. He would cut through the shields, through both of Vastor's arms, slash deep into his chest to quench the blade's fire in Vastor's smoking heart. But the shields did not cut. and they did not give way. Their singing whine hummed into Mace's hands, up his arms, to shiver in his chest and buzz in his teeth. Then he was past, flipping over Vaster's head. He landed and whirled to face the Lorpelic, his blades crossed in the defensive X.
It will hurt deeper to find you dead. Stand down.
Mace ground his teeth together, panting harshly.
Leave this place, Carvaster. I won't let you harm these children.
I have no interest in them. I do not make war on children.
Mace's response was a grimly silent stare at Terrell's corpse.
He was man enough to try to kill. He was man enough to die. What he did was not war, but attempted murder. What should I have done? Look around you, Doshalo. In this jungle, have you seen a jail?
If I had, Mace said through his teeth, I would put you in it.
But instead, you stand there, panting with hope and fear.
Jedi do not fear, Mace told him. Hope I left behind on Coruscant.
You hope I will threaten the children. You fear I might not. You hope I will give you an excuse to kill me. You fear to simply act.
Mace stared. In his reflection on Vaster's humming shields, he saw himself as though he looked upon a shatter point in his own nature. What Vaster had said, it was true. It was all true. He burned with blood fever, ached to kill the Lorpelic the same way that Vaster had killed Terrell, and for the same reason. In putting himself between Vaster and the children, he hadn't been seeking to defend innocent lives. He'd been seeking justifiable homicide. A perfectly Jedi murder. Like a faceful of icy water, it shocked him from a dream. Now, for the first time, the flame-lit bunker looked real. He looked at Vaster with his own eyes, truly open for the first time. Vaster looked back intently. After a moment, the Lorpelic relaxed with a sigh, lowering his weapons.
You have decided to let me live,
was the meaning of his wordless grumble.
For now.
Without another word, Vaster stalked out into the firelit night. Mace stood in the flickering dark, his only light the shine from his blades. After a time, his hands went numb on the hand grip's activation plates, and his blades shrank to nothingness.
Master Windu!
The voice was familiar, but it seemed to come from very far away. Or perhaps it was only an echo of memory.
Master Windu!
He stood staring into an invisible distance until a strong hand took his arm.
Hey, Mace!
He sighed.
Nick, what do you want?
It's almost dawn. Gunships fly with the light. It won't take them long to get here. Time to saddle up.
His voice stopped, as though he choked on something.
Frag me. What did you... I mean, what did they... Who? How?
His voice ran down. Mace finally turned to face the young Corrin. Nick stared speechlessly down at the bloody messes that were Besh and Chalk. The thanatazine has slowed the hemorrhaging, Mace said softly. Someone who's good with a Medpack's tissue binder might still be able to save their lives.
And are those children?
Apparently some Balawai don't lead them in the cities after all. Mace drifted toward the bunker's shattered doorway.
Hey, hold on! Where do you think you're going?
Parents of these children were out there. They may still be alive.
But Besh and Chalk,
Nick insisted.
What about Besh and Chalk? You can't just walk out of here and leave them.
They are in your care now. I could not protect them. Mace lowered his head as he walked away, and lowered his voice as well. I could not even protect myself.
But Mace! Master Windu!
Nick called after him.
Mace!
Mace stopped and looked back. Nick stood framed in the bunker's dark mouth, its twisted jags of durasteel surrounding him like teeth.
What about the kids? What am I supposed to do with them?
Pretend they are your own, Mace said, and turned away. The compound was full of armed Koronai, who were looting the scattered corpses with the same swift efficiency Mace had seen from Nick and Chalk and Besh and Lesh back in that Pelagbaugh alleyway. The sky burned with dawn, as though the clouds had caught fire. The 12 axe now stood in a ring around a couple dozen shivering Balawai. The captives huddled together, holding each other, watching the gorillas, eyes empty of hope and blank with terror. Rankin was not among the captives, nor was the girl's mother. Mace knew neither had escaped. Vaster was nearby, growling and barking and snarling the Koronai into groups organized for the withdrawal. In his disconnected state, Mace felt no surprise to discover that he could not now understand the Lor Pelic. Vaster's voice had become jungle noise, freighted with meaning, but indecipherable, inhuman, impersonal, lethal. Mace put out a hand to stop Vaster as the Lor Pelic swept by him. "What will you do with the captives?" Vaster rumbled wordlessly in his throat, and now again his meaning unfurled in Mace's mind.
"They come with us.
You can take care of prisoners."
"We don't take care of them. We give them to the jungle."
"The Tan Peltrokal," Mace murmured. "Jungle justice." Vaster nodded as he turned to move on.
"It is our way."
"Is that different from murder?"
Though Mace was looking at Vaster, he sounded like he was asking himself.
"Can any of them survive? Cast out alone? Without supplies? Without weapons?"
The Lor Pelic gave Mace a predator's grin over his shoulder, showing his needle-sharp teeth.
"I did,"
he growled, and walked away.
"And the children?"
But Mace was talking to the Lor Pelic's departing back. Vaster was already snapping at three or four ragged young Koronai. Mace thought about the dark. The Jedi metaphor of the dark side of the Force had never seemed so appropriate before. Less the dark of evil than the dark of a starless night, where what you think is a vine cat is only a bush, and what appears to be a tree may very well be a killer standing motionless, waiting for you to look away. Mace had read Temple archive accounts written by Jedi who had brushed the dark and recovered. These accounts often mentioned how the dark side seems to make everything clear. Mace knew now that this was only a delusion, a lie. The truth was exactly opposite. There was so much dark here, he might as well be blind. Morning sun struck the compound and brought gunships with it. Six of them, a double flight, roaring straight in from the stinging glare of Al-Har as it cleared the mountains. Their formation blossomed into a rosette as they peeled off to angle for staggered crisscrossing strafing runs. Mace still didn't move. Might as well be blind, he thought. And perhaps he also said it aloud. For the voice that spoke from behind him seemed to be answering. The wisest man I know once told me, it is in the darkest night that the light we are shines brightest. A woman's voice, cracking with exhaustion and hoarse with old pain. And perhaps it was only this voice that could have kindled a torch in Mace's vast darkness. Only this voice that could have brought Mace to his feet, turning, hope blooming inside his head, almost happy, almost even smiling. He turned, his arms opening, his breath catching, and all he could say was, "Deepa!" But she did not come to his embrace, and the hope inside him sputtered and died. His arms fell to his sides. Even prepared by what Nick had told him, he was not remotely ready for this. Jedi Master Deepa Bilaba stood before him in the tattered remnants of Jedi robes, stained with mud and blood and jungle sap. Her face was pale and lined with fatigue, and had gone so thin her cheekbones stood out like blades. Her mouth seemed lipless and hard, and bore a fresh burn scar from one corner to the tip of her chin. But these were not the worst of it. None of these were what kept Mace motionless, as though nailed to the ground. even as gunships swept overhead and rained blaster fire on the compound around them. In the inferno of explosions, amidst the whine of rock splinters and the hammering webwork of particle beams, Mace could only stare at Deepa's forehead, where she had once worn the shining golden bead of the Mark of Illumination, the symbol of a Chalactan adept. The Mark of Illumination is affixed to the frontal bone of an adept's skull by the elders of that ancient religion as a symbol of the unclosable eye that is the highest expression of the Chalactan enlightenment. Deepa had worn hers with pride for 20 years. Now, where the mark had been was only an ugly ripple of keloid scar, as though the same knife that had slashed away her hair had crudely hacked the symbol of her ancestral religion from the bone of her skull. And across her eyes, she wore a strip of rag tied like a blindfold, a rag as weathered and stained and ragged as her robes themselves. "Hello, Mace," she said sadly. "You shouldn't have come."
From the private journals of Mace Windu.
"I finally understand what I'm doing here, why I came. I understand the hypocrisy of that list of reasons I offered to Yoda and to Palpatine in the Chancellor's office those weeks ago. I was lying to them, and to myself. I must have seen the real reason I came here in the first instant I turned to her in the compound, in the pain-etched creases below her cheekbones, in the scar where the mark of enlightenment had been. Yes, it wasn't really her. It was a force vision, a hallucination, a lie. But even a lie of the force is more true than any reality our limited minds can comprehend. I didn't come here to learn what has happened to Deepa, nor to protect the reputation of our order. I did not come to fight this war. I don't care who wins, because no one wins, not in a real war. It is only a question of how much each side is willing to lose. I did not come here to apprehend or kill a rogue Jedi, or even to judge one. I didn't come here to stop Deepa. I came here to save her. I will save her. And may the Force have mercy on any who would try to stop me, for I will have none."
From the private journals of Mace Windu.
"I don't remember leaving the compound. I suppose I must have been in some kind of shock. Kar Vastor. I have much to say of this Lor Pelek, of the powers I have seen him wield, from the drawing of the fever wasps out of Besh and Chalk, to the way the jungle itself seems to part for his passage and tangle itself behind. Of his followers, those 6 Koronai he calls the Ak Guards, men he's made into lesser echoes of himself. How he has trained them in their signature weapons, those terrifying vibro-shields that he had created. Even the smallest details, the primal ferocity of his gaze, the jungle noise growl of his wordless voice, and how you hear his meaning as though it is your own voice whispering inside your head, deserve more depth of comment than I can give them here. I'm not sure why it took me so long to understand that he and I are natural enemies.